Welcome you all to Dean Seminar. My name is Roger Kane, those who don't know me. I'm the Dean of the School of Advanced Study here from the University of London. It's a real delight to welcome Nicola and Jenny to give a seminar today. They're going to be talking on aspects of some ongoing research that's carried on one of the school's institutes, in the Institute of Historical Research. That's research on history and education. It's a project that's funded externally by the Lindbergh Trust, I think, and is led by Professor David Cannadine, who is one of the, what will be a joint author of the final work, which I understand is due to be sent off to the press sometime in the end of this calendar year.
Sooner than that.
Yeah.
Some probably this month or next
month. Yeah. So we are then, having a preview of something which we will all be able to read about in greater detail when it is printed. So it's a real privilege to have you both here. Nicola and Jenny both got doctorates in the history of education. History in education is a really sort of full of controversy and debate at the moment amongst professional historians and politicians about what is the kind of history that should be part of the curriculum for people who are going through state education in the United Kingdom, and we might get some insights into that from your analysis of the history of history education, which will obviously be perhaps of interest to those who are making contemporary policy. So Nicola and Jenny are going to perform as a duo. Jenny, I think you're starting, is that right?
Yeah.
And then hand over to Nicola, and then we'll have time for some questions at the end. So, Jenny, can I invite you to give us your piece, please?
Hello, everybody. Vast audience. School history in the 20th century, a story of declinal progress. The trouble with our self-imposed title is that it raises more questions than we can ever answer. History in schools is now a political issue rather than a purely pedagogic one. What one group of people, probably politicians or historians, see as decline, another group, probably educationists, see as progress. Nicola will talk in more detail about contemporary issues. I will consider the state of school history in the past, the fairly distant past, a period up to the 1960s, often painted as the golden age of history teaching, when every child knew the date of the Battle of Trafalgar, and which monarch came after William Rufus. First, a brief introduction, which I know Roger's already partly given, to the project we've been working on for the last 2 years. It's called the History and Education Project, and is part of the Institute of Historical Research. It's funded by the Lindbergh Trust, the charitable trust, and the director is Professor Sir David Cannadine. The project's brief was to investigate and analyse the development of history teaching in English state schools from 1900 to the present. With this in mind, we've been to archives and libraries around the country, collected and photographed people's history exercise books and project work, and interviewed former pupils, history teachers, educationalists, and former secretaries of state for education. We sent out survey forms to history teachers, past and present, and former pupils. Over 300 completed them, giving a fascinating picture of people's memories of being taught history. The project was divided chronologically. I looked at the period 1900 to the 1960s, and Nicola, the period from the 60s to now. We've decided to do this presentation the same way. I'll first consider the state of history teaching between 1900 and the 60s. Nicola will discuss the 1960s to the present. In keeping with our periods, I will give a straightforward lecture, virtually chalk and talk with lantern slides, and Nicola will give a presentation with sound clips. In many ways, decline and progress in an area like the teaching of history can only be judged by looking at what people wanted history teaching to achieve, and then considering how far the actual practice of the teaching measured up to these demands. But of course, this is not simple, as is all too obvious at the moment. Different interest groups have differing, even opposing views of what they want to come out of school history teaching. And it's very hard for all schools to achieve uniform standards of history teaching. So much of what is achieved depends on the chemistry of child and teacher, particularly in the earlier period, when history teaching relied on little other than the personality of the teacher, rather than the aids and technology available to modern history teachers. One lady who received our survey form sent it on to three friends from her former class at the Direct Grant School in London in the late 1940s. Despite all being in the same history lessons, they had astonishingly different recollections and reactions to the teaching. One had adored it and had vivid memories of it. Another could remember almost nothing. The third disliked it and dropped it for science. And the fourth found the lessons boring, but eventually got hooked on studying history in later life. All this shows is the subjectivity of people's opinions, which I suppose rather negates some of our research. And as we weren't measuring people's knowledge of history, it doesn't reveal anything about how effective the teaching actually was. In fact, at the end of the 19th century, I was surprised to find how very little history was taught. In elementary schools, which most children attended, a convoluted system called payment by results meant it was financially disadvantageous for many schools to teach history. In a way, almost analogous to the contemporary problem of schools dropping history at GCSE level because it's seen as academically difficult, and thus less likely to attract the necessary A to C grades to raise the school in the league tables. Schools in the 1890s found it not worth their while to teach history. And indeed, in the 1880s, history was only allowed to be taught to children in standard 5 and above, 11 to 12 year olds. Now, this gives you some detailed figures. So in 1890, of the 22,500 elementary schools, history was only taught in 414, which shows. By 1903, various changes in the funding system meant, in fact, virtually all history, all elementary schools taught history. Big change. Admittedly, this hadn't meant that pupils necessarily had no exposure to history. Some of their readers, the basic books they used to practice reading, would have included historical stories, these kind of books. But to all intents and purposes, they were receiving no historical instruction prior to the early 1900s. This is really significant because although the elementary schools were the precursors of primary schools, they were the only schools that the vast majority of children, probably 95 in every 100, attended. These schools finished at 14, which was the official leaving age, although many children left considerably earlier because of a variety of loopholes and local bylaws which wouldn't be finally removed until the 1920s. Class sizes were usually enormous. 60 children with one teacher was quite normal, and rote learning and strict discipline were inevitable, because how else could order be kept with so many pupils? In secondary schools, there was more teaching of history at the end of the 19th century, although even this was new. The Clarendon and Taunton Commissions, which looked at public schools and endowed grammar schools in the 1860s, had shown that even the most established public schools had very little history teaching. There was no organised system of state secondary schools, and as we've seen, relatively very few children attended them. But there was a network around grammar schools for boys, and during the later part of the 19th century, girls' schools had been established by various charitable trusts. By the end of the 19th century, it appears that most of these were providing 1 to 2 hours of history teaching a week, although the standard was often not high. A report published in 1902 on literary subjects in secondary schools by the Board of Education, the government department overseeing schools, made depressing reading. So the masters must have no knowledge on the subject except what they gave them, the book which the boys use. And the same book should be used in several successive forms. Herein chosen study is determined by the syllabus and examination. And boys studying the Wars of the Roses are quite ignorant of all previous history. Very similar criticisms to the kind of criticisms we're made about history teaching now. Mm-hmm. However, the beginning of the 20th century saw efforts from various sides to improve standards of education in general, and the teaching of history in particular. As England's position as the main imperial nation came under threat, there was a growing awareness that its workforce must become more, both more technically skilled and also better educated in a wider sense if the country wasn't to fall behind countries like Germany and the United States. The much-quoted shock at the poor physical condition of potential army recruits during the Boer War was mirrored in concern about the educational standards of the working class, Changes were made. From 1902, local authorities were encouraged to establish secondary schools. And from 1907, all those which received government funding for this had to provide at least 25% of the places without fees to elementary school pupils. By the 1920s, about one in every 10 children in England attended a secondary school. The Edwardian years also saw the phasing out of the old pupil-teacher system, which had been criticised for producing narrow, ill-educated and repressive teaching. From now on, most teachers in elementary schools would receive 2 years of college training, although until the early 1970s there was no statutory requirement for any formal teacher training for graduates teaching in secondary schools. In 1906, following the establishment of associations to foster the development of subjects like classics, mathematics, English and geography, the Independent Historical Association was set up with the initial main aim of giving history teachers support and practical advice. And in the early 1900s, the Board of Education itself produced guidance for the teaching of history in both elementary and secondary schools. This guidance was always, it was stressed, advice only, never compulsory, although it was recommended that they follow it. What was the advice? For younger children, it was to tell them stories of great historical figures. So, typical heroes or heroines. These would be treated in the main with a view to illustrating the action of real persons, the principles of conduct and qualities of character which promote the welfare of the individual and of society. So very much a kind of moral standpoint here that they were trying to get over. But at the end, it does say the teacher should take care not to raise them too far above the level of common humanity by the omission of their faults or shortcomings. So they were attempting to make these like real people. And also it was stressed that there should be heroines as well as heroes. So there was again an attempt to bring women into all this. And I certainly remember learning about people like Bogusia and Florence Nightingale. Well, I wasn't quite at school in the early 1900s. Not much change as we were here. For older pupils, a complete account of English or British, the two were used interchangeably, history was recommended, with, particularly in secondary schools, some emphasis on European history, at least as it related to English history. This could be taught chronologically in stages over 3 years or 4 to 5 years, depending on whether the children were in elementary or secondary school. Or it could be taught concentrically, an odd-sounding system in which the pupils were taught the complete account of history every year, each time doing it in more detail. Its advantage was that those who left school early would still get some overall idea of the whole. But it sounds extraordinarily difficult to teach successfully. Running through the advice were strong recommendations to encourage and foster the love of country and patriotic feelings. So this is a typical kind of thing that the government would say, very much about liberty, freedom, tolerance, those things. There was an undercurrent of anxiety among the establishment that unrest and dissent might still lurk among sections of the working class after the major strikes and demonstrations of the 1880s and 90s. Trade unions and the New Labour Party were active, and it was important to establish a broad acceptance and enthusiasm for the existing status quo. History teaching was seen as having a potential part to play in this, although it was rarely spelled out that this was the main point of children studying history. Indeed, throughout the century and right up to the present day, there's been a confusion about how to combine the teaching of history, the teaching of the rights and responsibilities of citizenship, the teaching of patriotism, love of one's country, and the teaching of pride in one's country, which is slightly different. For most of the first half of the 20th century, these were all seen as important reasons for studying history. Having said this, the official guidance was always, throughout the first half of the 20th century, keen to disassociate itself from jingoism and national stereotyping. Some of the popular textbooks showed no such reticence. Now, this is a couple of quotes from a very popular textbook. One of its authors was Rudyard Kipling, very famous, and full of generalizations about nations. So Ireland's a spoiled child, Russia's half barbarous, full of very brave, very stupid soldiers, the French are cunning. I mean, in four lines, you've got three national stereotypes. But long before the First World War, many educationists and even quite traditionalist teachers like this one, who taught at a public school, somewhere, were already keen to distance themselves from what was seen as jingoism, which is a militaristic, xenophobic form of patriotism. So he thinks, he likes the idea of using history teaching to teach, to instill patriotism, but he does want to get away from the foolish brave superiority to the foreigner, which he does feel compelled. Government guidance on history teaching developed over the first 60 years of the 20th century, but only quite slowly. Not until the 1950s did it begin to sound markedly different from the early 1900s, and that was more in terms of style and content. However, although all the old content was still advocated, much throughout the second half century, much more was being recommended as well, putting history teachers in what must have been an almost impossible position, as they were ready to attempt to do it all. Even in 1905, the Board of Education had admitted that teaching history in schools, all schools, was very difficult because of the, quote, wide scope of the subject, the doubt in which many past events are involved, and the controversial aspect of not a few historical questions. But by the late 1920s, the recommended syllabus had become much more crowded, with recommendations about studying world history and the League of Nations, as well as a stern warning about maintaining the learning of dates. For a time, some teachers tried to do without dates, with the result that many children lost all sense of historical sequence. All the teachers now recognise that some dates are necessary. And, well, here it doesn't actually mention the League of Nations, but in fact in 1927 these recommendations, these suggestions had a whole supplement at the back on the history and development of the League of Nations, and it was definitely, and it was strongly recommended that schools should teach to this appendix. It does, the Board of Education does admit at the bottom that this is the ideal, it is recognised to obtain it fully, maybe beyond the reach of many schools. There was also the pressure of examination syllabuses for children in secondary schools. The majority of children in the elementary schools and the post-primary schools which developed from them, senior and central schools, did not take any external examinations. But for those who did, the criticisms of the examination system were similar to now. Far too much concentration on the exam syllabuses to the exclusion of all else. Repetition of the same periods so the pupils would do well in the final examination. From the memoirs and reminiscences of former pupils in the pre-First World War era, and from our completed survey forms and interviews with former pupils at school in the interwar years and the 1950s, and from school inspectors' reports, it does seem that history was generally taught in the basic way that the Board of Education recommended. Stories for younger pupils, and for older ones, a basis of chronological British or English history, with occasional forays into Europe, or occasionally the world. A government survey in 1926 of a representative sample of 41 London elementary schools showed that most schools taught syllabuses concerned exclusively with the story of Britain and the British Empire. Recommendations by the London County Council that pupils should receive some notion of world history appear to have little effect, according to the report. Although in about a quarter of the London services there was some reference to the League of Nations. As has been suggested already, the syllabus in these schools was deemed, almost without exception, overloaded with material. The report gives an example of one school syllabus which included over 50 different topics for study over the year, at a school where only 1 hour a week was allowed for history. These ranged from the early English town to the trade wars of the 18th century. So they would be, and that's a, those would be given an hour a week, literally an hour on the trade wars of the 18th century. These were at least in chronological order through the year. The syllabus for younger children consisted of biographical stories as recommended. But these often lacked interest or historical significance, according to the report, and were not always presented chronologically. So in one school, 1 week, Captain Scott was taught, the following week, Stevenson and the Railway, and then the following week, Joan of Arc. So, not surprisingly, from the beginning of the 20th century, there were always suggestions of different ways of teaching. And by the 1930s, a range of approaches to history teaching were being tried in a few schools. What most of the educationists and teachers devising these new ways had in common was a criticism of the way in which history was taught in schools. The principal criticism was that it was taught in a dull, repetitive way, which allowed pupils no chance to use their initiative or imagination. They felt children were leaving school with little interest in history and little real knowledge or understanding. Even in 1900, a number of books were in print offering original source material for pupils to use as part of their historical studies. And in 1910, an educationist, M.W. Keating, no relation to me, put forward a whole way of teaching history based on the use of original texts. His ideas were not instantly taken up, but were gradually influential through the next 50 years. Other ways of innovative teaching included the use of drama, where children did their own research to devise historical plays, the Dalton Plan, which was a progressive philosophy of teaching, where children did intensive personal research on their own in their own time, Papel's advocacy of history as a training in imaginative understanding, M.C. Jeffrey's Lines of Development, where pupils study topics like transport, medicinal clothing, right through history, and the use of patches, which was very popular in the 1950s, where a small period of history would be studied intensively so pupils could immerse themselves in it. All these approaches and others were used in some schools, and teachers adapted aspects of them to suit their own teaching. And the other thing they all have is that they do at least pay lip service to chronology. And for example, the patches system will always have a time chart accompanying it, so that you could actually see where the period of history fitted in. None of these approaches have swept through teaching and has used generations of teachers. By the 1950s, history teaching does seem pretty stale. Most children were now taught in secondary moderns. In theory, these children were not taking external examinations, so their teachers could teach interesting new syllabuses using the ideas I've just mentioned, bringing in social and economic and world history in innovative ways. Some of these do seem to have attempted this, but many continue to teach mainly chronological history. And increasingly, pupils in secondary modern schools began to take public examinations, ordinary level and others, as O-level and others, as it was realised how vital qualifications were going to be in the post-war era. So they too, like their counterparts in the grammar schools, were more and more locked into syllabuses set by the examination boards. We have many survey forms from former pupils in the 1950s, mainly from grammar schools, but not all, still describing a basic chalk and talk way of teaching, often using notes and multiple blackboards. What is particularly striking from all of them is the importance of the teacher. A good teacher doing chalk and talk often inspired the pupils with a love of history forever. A poor one put them off the subject for life. So, did the teaching of history decline or progress during this period? If it improved generally, that was partly because of wider changes in schools by the end of the 1950s. Better qualified teachers, smaller classes, improving buildings, the rise of technological aids, radio, film, the beginnings of television schools broadcasting. There were glimmerings of differing approaches to history teaching. There was a consciousness that history teaching should not be jingoistic, but might develop a sense of patriotism and citizenship. There were ideas that Britain or England's history should be seen in the wider context of the world. But all of this was hard to do given constraints of time and resources. One of the problems in this period is that there is no overarching vision of what good history teaching should be. The government left it vague, and educationalists have different ideas. I personally think that Miss Howard, who was head of the history department at the Londonderry Training College, later the Institute of Education, came close to offering such a vision in 1906. So, I don't know if you can read this. We should all agree that the history lesson can give, as no other school subject can, training what is perhaps the most necessary quality for success in life, that quality for which in English language we only have the unsatisfactory word sympathy. In learning history, the child is always, or should be always, exercising his imagination, projecting himself backwards into the past, looking at things from other people's point of view, picturing circumstances widely different from his own. Some children do this instinctively, but mostly in a good deal of guidance. Then too, the history lessons may give valuable preparation for afterlife by training the children reasoning. Not in the abstract reasoning maths or mathics, but in reasoning and judgments of vital human affairs. They cannot indeed always learn the why, but we can teach them to want to know the why, and to form the habit of reasoning from the knowledge they already have. Unfortunately, she wasn't accompanying this quite, I think, passionate vision of history with a scheme or a system. She just had sensible suggestions for how to teach large classes in a fairly traditional way. It would be hard to claim that school history teaching in the first 60 years of the 20th century was achieving what Miss Howard suggested to any substantial extent. By the 1960s, history teaching was probably ripe for change and development. What happened next will be the subject of Nicholas' paper. Thank you very much.
So shall we run straight on then, Nicholas?
Yeah, sure.
I think it's probably best.
Yes. Then we'll do questions together at the end.
Considerable change in the teaching of history in both primary and secondary schools. But it's not one of those simple stories, you know, like the Whig story of history, you know, it's progress from beginning to end at all, with change only in one direction. The change that I'm going to outline resulted from a combination of what might be called external and internal pressures on the subject of the teachers. Some of the reactions were defensive, save history. Whereas others were a matter of cultural shift and changes in the way in which people thought about children's learning. So those two things worked together. Now, as is well known, the Conservative government at the end of the 1980s attempted to overturn those developments, but the triumph of the right was by no means secure or complete. As I will show, it was a typical British compromise and did nothing to halt the progress of what was known as new history. Indeed, political decisions in the 1980s actually secured the strong influence of new history on history teaching and eventually extended to A-level. So, I'll explain why this happened, and thus why we are currently at the same crossroads again now. On the one hand, the alleged, by the right, Michael Gove, etc., decline of history in schools. That is to say, the knowledge of dates and events, the understanding of chronology and the appreciation of the national narrative. And on the other, the progress of history at both GCSE and A-level, if you look at the numbers taking it, more than ever taking history, and its popularity in the public domain, more TV programmes concerned with history than with any other academic area on popular TV and radio at the moment. Although my approach is broadly chronological, I have identified a number of crucial shifts in the teaching of history which form the major changes over the past 50 years. Firstly, between the 1960s and the early 1980s, there is what might be called the imaginative turn in school history. The roots of this go back into the 1930s, as Jenny has already described. But it was in the 1960s that primary schools in particular, embracing the ideology of the child-centred curriculum, started to place the child's imagination at the core of learning and its immediate world of experience as the touchstone of knowledge. In one sense, this was inimical to history. It was something which would threaten history, because much of history is necessarily exotic to the world of the child aged between 5 and 11. Things that would normally be in the curriculum would be totally outside their experience. Although the Plowman Report of 1967 saw a place in history, it tended to prefer to see it as a combined subject with geography or religious studies and focus very much on the local and personal. Penelope Harnett, a young primary teacher, noticed the difference from her first school, where the rigid timetable included the traditional stories of historical characters based on the books of R.J. Olmsted. So here's Penelope as a part of an interview. Which is the definite scheme of work at this first school she went to. We did Olmsted, you'd have cavemen to Vikings, then there must have been a medieval and Tudor one, and then year five, we've done the Georgians, the Victorians for year six. So it's British history chronological run through. We had these special books where you had a blank at the top of the page, then you had lines underneath, and so I would tell the children a story, then they would draw a picture of the story, and then I would write on the blackboard what they had to write about the story underneath in their best handwriting. And they were marked then not on their historical knowledge or anything like that, but how nicely they copied from the board. So not history teaching as we know it today. Now, she moved on to a school with a child-centred approach. The day here was the teacher's structure, there was no timetable, and topics were the fashion. Children's learning was based on a cross-subject approach around a single theme. And here she's commenting on that. Teachers then will be doing things like transport, history of transport, or awful topics like colour. If you had colour, you'd do the rainbow for biblical things, and you'd do chromatography probably for science. You'd do colour mixing for art, and for drama, you'd do the angry colours. It would have been, say, Josephine's amazing technical dream coat for colour. I don't know what would come in for history. If you were doing water, which was another one, you'd do ships through the ages, or canals, and Noah's flood. So she goes on to describe how teachers would sort of piece together subjects around a topic. Children's reading books had stopped including history stories. The idea was misplaced. You had to have stories about children's everyday life. It was all child-centeredness. So Penelope was saying sort of history had got sort of shut out, really, from the idea of learning for primary, particularly for infant younger children. On the other hand, some primary school teachers loved history, and we incorporated it as much as possible because that was a choice. It was entirely out of teacher. Another teacher we interviewed, Roberta Wood, teaching in Northumberland, went with her primary school to a ruined castle to experience medieval life. And this is very much an example of the imaginative turn. We tried to rig up all the children in something approaching a medieval costume. We said they had to take a medieval lunch. You couldn't buy a carton of apple juice in that local area the day after, because that was the only thing we would let them drink. That, milk, or water. And they could take boiled eggs and chicken leg, and anything that was around in medieval time, which eliminated crisps, chocolate biscuits, anything like that. So a very healthy lunch. When we got to Aidan Castle, we did a play, they could dip candles, they could write with quill pens. The whole school, I think, enjoyed it. For them to experience what it was like and how cold it could be was very good. So the sensory element of this as well was important. Changes in textbooks and the spread of radio and TV in the classroom all helped to reinforce the emphasis on imagination as the basis for history teaching in primary schools. Olmsted's books were actually part of that trend. Although traditional in content in that they had a chronological account of British history, they contained very few dates. They were lavishly illustrated to excite the imagination, and focused on daily life as much as great events. Now, these, actually only Crown and Park, which is for older children, focuses on political events. The other ones here focus on personalities or a lifestyle, see inside a castle, looking at history. They tend to focus on the lives of ordinary people. Radio dramatisation. So this one, not so long ago, is radio history programmes for young children. And on the right, we've got How We Used to Live. These invited children to use their imaginations. TV particularly thrived on the historical drama, such as the popular How We Used to Live historical soap, which was produced by Yorkshire TV between 1968 and 2002, fondly remembered by many of our survey respondents, and watched by an estimated 85% of primary schools. So in some senses, TV started to provide an alternative, a complete historical curriculum for schools. This freer approach to the curriculum was a product not only of pedagogical change, it was enabled by the abolition of the 11 plus. The upper primary years were no longer hamstrung by testing which tied pupils to a relentless diet of verbal reading and maths tests. The progress of comprehensive education, by 1980 approximately 80% of children were in non-selective schools in Britain, and profound effects on history in the secondary schools also. Although it would be true to say that traditional history did linger on well into the 1970s, I'm now going to show you actually a typical secondary history course pre-1970s, into the 1970s, this is from 1976, as it shows you, it's pretty much a chronological run-through of British history, with a diversion at 14 to 16, but mainly still British history for the O-level courses then. So, as you can see, you didn't actually reach the 20th century before 14, so if you gave up history at 14, you might have finished anywhere between 1689 and 1914, depending on how fast your teacher went. I'm also going to show you some of the work that, can you see it? I've picked these because they were clearer. Sometimes you just see pages of notes that students have copied down from the board. This side, this is the scramble for Africa that this child has copied from the board and coloured in. And underneath it says, in the early 19th century, in Africa, British possessions were confined to forts and slave trading stations along the west coast. So it's told from a completely British imperial perspective, studying Africa as an opportunity for colonialism rather than having a history in its own right. On this side, that's from 1974, that one. This side I've got in Coldwell 1960, and here the teacher has done a diagram to illustrate the political arrangements under the Anglo-Saxons and then under the Normans. And you notice he's put no equivalent of the House of Commons. So the teacher's put a little bit of political education in there as well. But for many children, it was a political history primarily that they would cover from perhaps in the first year, starting with ancient civilizations, but moving rapidly on to 1066 and then through the various kings and queens and the events of their reigns. In the lower years, however, the imaginative approach could be employed without much risk to the pupils' exam performance in the fifth form. And this approach was supported by a gradually improving range of textbooks, some with a wide range of photographs of authentic historical sites and objects. So it's a crossover period in the 70s, really. This is a very popular textbook produced by Longmans, one of the most significant publishers for secondary history. It's designed for the first year of secondary school for 11 and 12 year olds. Lavish illustrated, as you can see, with authentic photographs. This is obviously a classical mosaic here. Now, what you notice also is that the text is narrative text. There's no questions, there's nothing to provoke thought, there's no instructions for the teacher about what they should do. It's simply to provide information that the teacher can then use. But nonetheless, stimulating to the imagination to see real historical objects. Comprehensive schools provided both a challenge and an opportunity for history teachers. The big new schools needed a new all-ability curriculum, and it was clear that the old grammar school diet of dictated notes was not going to meet the needs of the 80% of pupils unlikely to reach O-level standards. So 80% of pupils were not really being catered for by the old-fashioned history. This is not to say that secondary modern schools are not taught history, that was never a priority subject. Some secondary modern teachers relish the challenge of finding practical approaches to teaching history. And this is from an interview with one of them. This is Eric Holdu, who was teaching in West Yorkshire in the 60s. He shared his amateur passion for archaeology with his students. We were lucky because the school was very close to a Roman road, and I made sure we went out looking at the cross as they grew over the Roman road, or didn't grow where the paving was. It's a ready-made success in a way, because if you can talk about places the kids know, put a time emphasis onto it, they suddenly realise that where they are actually has a history. In some cases, going back 2,000 years in the case of a Roman road, and it went across the fields behind the school, and I could show it them on aerial photographs. Now, Eric actually took a lot of different types of little trips for his students. He took them to a ruined Anglo-Saxon chapel, for instance, and he also took them to industrial archaeology sites. And I've got a little clip, so let's see if we... So I'm talking about CSE, which was introduced in 1963 and aimed at the 40% of pupils below O-level, 40% below, so still another 40% with nothing, but all the same. And he talks here about it.
So what are you referring to? Did you enter any pupils for CSEs?
Yes, it started when I was there, and I became very enthusiastic about it. We attended meetings, and I liked it. Well, I'm pretty certain about it. History was the first subject, other than I think biology, to specify fieldwork.
Did the fieldwork, was that mainly focused on archaeological
investigation? It was, but including industrial archaeology, which was very fashionable in the 60s. Somebody had just invented it. And I liked it, as you'd imagine, because of the fieldwork going on. And we took children out and did actual work. I've sorted out press copies and photographs here somewhere. That is one that I did from Featherstone, where we helped to restore an old water mill. And I had an article in the Times about that.
These are the photographs that he gave me. They're not all from the water mill, actually. That first one isn't. That's the Anglo-Saxon chapel, actually. But as you can see, it's very active, practical learning based around history, which is very suitable for the children that he was teaching. In addition to that, CSE coursework could allow students to do their own photographs and go out and investigate their own topics. And here's one from another teacher who was teaching in Norfolk at a secondary modern school. A student who's photographed buildings and actually written up the history of, I'm not sure what it was, a station, I think, a railway station. So students were doing things for themselves, so a completely different approach to the teaching of history. However, I have to say, we're talking here about the enthusiastic and committed teacher prepared to put in the hours to sort this out. And that is not the majority of history teachers. By the late 60s, it was clear that history was actually losing out to modern subjects on the curriculum in comprehensive schools, such as social studies, and sometimes it was being integrated into a sort of humanities to make space on the curriculum. There was a fear that it was in danger even of disappearing from the school curriculum altogether, and surveys of less able pupils put history near the bottom in terms of its popularity. They were seeing it as boring and useless. Martin Booth, a teacher educator, he followed the study of history teaching in five different secondary schools. He visited them and surveyed students. And he concluded, in 1965, history in school appeared to be a dreary desert, where as far as the eye could see, row upon row of school children sit, writing endless notes. But what can be done? Now, the answer to that question, what can be done, was new history. It was very much a product of the 1960s, but gradually came to dominate the teaching of history in state secondary schools. So what exactly is new history, and how did it come to dominate? Now, new history is most commonly associated with something called the School's Council History Project, which began as a pilot course for O-level and CSE in 1972. Although at the time, it was only one of a number of curriculum initiatives in different parts of the country. It was funded by the School's Council, a body which had been set up by the Wilson government in 1964 to promote curriculum innovation. Now, initially, the Schools Council concentrated on science and languages, which were thought to be subjects that needed a boost. But in the early 70s, inspectors, school inspectors in the field of history, fearing that history was under real threat, persuaded them to fund a project for history, 13-16 project. The whole thing was in fact controlled by teachers and teacher educators. It was not, although the school's council is the first example of the central government getting involved in curriculum, it was very much a devolved format at that stage. So the school's council history project, as it developed, was the product of, if you like, forward-thinking teachers who were committed to changing this dry-as-dust approach to history. Now, the philosophical influence on the project came mainly from Archie Collingwood's The Idea of History. Since David Sylvester, who was the first project leader, director for the school's council history project. Under this idea, the teaching of history was seen as an active engagement with the sources of history, not a received narrative that one was taught. The pupils reconstructed the past and explained it themselves from the remnants of the past, the sources. It was not concerned with the received narrative, but with alternative explanations. One might disagree about what had actually happened and the meaning of it. Likewise, it was not concerned with the national narrative. I'm going to show you the outline. This is the Schools Council History Project curriculum. This is what students would have been taught in their last 2 years. In fact, the What is History bit, introductory investigations, would have been done in the third year at senior school. And then that introduced you to the idea of historical mysteries. One of them that was done, and referred to later, was the princes in the tower. Had Richard III murdered the princes in the tower? And were given evidence to look at, supporting one side or the other, and supposed to come up with some sort of idea about which might be more trustworthy or not. Could one answer that question? Then, during the course, as you can see, it combines together a number of different ideas about how student history, some of which Jenny's already mentioned. Local history, for instance, was included in the site visit. That, of course, had been explored by CSE teachers as part of the course within CSE. A study of development through time, thematic study, was included. A depth study, like a patch, to give students the opportunity to really get into a period and understand lots of aspects of it. Mm-hmm. And then a modern world study, the idea that understanding the contemporary conflicts and issues of the day was important to history. So the important thing about SCHP was none of this was completely new, but it did combine in one course all the new ideas from the previous 20, 30 years. It didn't privilege any historical content, certainly not a national narrative, although there's some British history, as you can see there. The topics offered do represent a broadly liberal left approach to history. Sylvester himself wanted the history of medicine, for instance. You see his Medicine Through Time, which looks from the Greeks to the modern day, covering surgery as well as midwifery, herbal approaches. You know, it covers the whole of medicine right through 2,000 years. He wanted that because it provided a contrast to the study of war, which is often the central narrative of development in political history courses. So you can see how there's a certain agenda coming through about what is helpful for children to learn, something positive rather than negative. It was a very 60s approach at the time, when the national narrative was certainly not in demand in schools. And not from government. There was no government impulse saying you've got to have traditional history at all. It was trying to be modern, and to meet that demand, the subject had to look relevant to the teenager. So it taught thinking skills, it taught local history, it broadened the teenager's view of the world with modern history, and it could thus fit to be a different and more modern type of history, which would engage teachers, teenagers and teachers of all abilities. For some teachers, it had a dramatic effect. Now, I'm going to use quite a long clip from the oral history, but it's quite a significant one. This is John D. Clare. John D. Clare retired after I'd interviewed him. He was deputy head teacher at Newton Aycliffe School in County Durham. It's an ordinary comprehensive school in the northeast of England. Spent most of his career there. But he's a very good teacher, I think. There's loads of tributes to him actually on the web because he's helped a lot with the teachers. So here he is talking about when he was a young teacher in 1974, I think, he went to a meeting about school's history project. This was the first time he'd heard anything about it. And the speaker was Dennis Shemmels, who was one of the team. So he refers to it in this clip. So please bear with me, it's 2 minutes long.
It was like a Damascus Road experience listening to him talk. It was an epiphany for me because suddenly he started, basically I realised that I had been up through O-level, A-level and I'd studied history at Oxford and I didn't have a clue about history, about the study of history. I didn't know what I was talking about. I couldn't tell you how to study a source. I didn't know. What did you look for when you studied the source? I mean, I'd used them, obviously. But in those days, what you used to do is you used your sources almost as part of an ongoing narrative. You merely produced them as sort of little bits of evidence that had to have that completely out of context. And the concept of history being based on sources was a radical, exciting idea for me. And then the idea that we might give sources to children and that they may study them and do them for themselves. And how do you teach them how to do this? And I was just, well, my life as a history teacher was changed by Dennis Shemmels. I went home a different man. And sort of, I suspect Dennis might be absolutely horrified by the way that my history's developed since, but he sent me down a road. And I just went away and got on with it then. Like Billy Graham, I only remember one thing he said, and somebody said to him, how can you put these sources before children when they are so difficult to understand and to read? And he said, barbarize, he said. I didn't even know what barbarizing was. I mean, I got the gist of what it meant from the context, but sort of, that was the only bit I remember, that he just said, barbarize, for God's sake. It was fabulous, and so I then began to change. I did not abandon some of the excited children love stories. They just love telling. I could sit down a set of the naughtiest year 9 pupils and least able year 9 pupils, because that's where I specialised for the last decade. Sort of, and I could talk to them for an hour about the murder of Franz Ferdinand at Sarajevo, and I won't pause for breath. And they will not one of them will glance sideways. I can keep them absolutely thrilled. The story side of history is, I think, still the big power of the children. But I went away and I began to understand that what we need to do as history teachers is to give them the bricks and let them begin to try and work and build their own history out of this.
Okay.
The interesting thing about that was that Mr. Clare added to, rather than replaced, his traditional approaches to teaching history. Story is still important, but you know, sources as well. And I suspect that's a mark of how many teachers approached it. This is a useful, interesting thing. I can add it into my current practice. SCHP was cleverly marketed with well-trialed materials for teachers to use. And a teachers' network for support was set up. Many local authorities had at that time established teacher centres for the local resources, and these proved to be really useful for getting teachers together and helping them to support one another with the delivery of the course. Some of the local authority advisors employed at that time promoted SCHP to schools in their area. So that helped the spread of it. Nonetheless, the progress of this new way of doing history, a bit like science, sort of discovery approach to doing history, was really gradual, because partly because teaching it demanded new expertise. I mean, how much would anyone know about the history of medicine? Having done an ordinary history degree, you would not have studied it. So it meant quite a lot of extra work to get into those topics. And all the teachers in a school's history department have to agree to do it. So by the early 1980s, approximately a third of all secondary schools were doing SCHP as their 14 to 16 course. But many more included source-based work in more conventional courses. And I wanted to show you some examples of work. Now, I saw you the earlier work where the pupils are just copied down from the board, the information. It's hard to see, I know, but okay, this one is Charlotte's work from the late 1970s, early 80s. This is from lower forms. It's not from the actual course, SCHP, but it shows the influence. And what what she's been asked to do is write about the Suffolk Mounds, the Sutton Hoo burial site. So this is a different way of studying Anglo-Saxon history. And she's written about the sort of things that were discovered in the tomb and what they might mean historically, and beautifully illustrated as well. So it's really trying to get her to look at the evidence that's been left behind by an Anglo-Saxon burial. So it's not telling her about King Alfred and the cave hunter. The other one is from much more recently, and it shows how this is still really the prevailing way of approaching history. This is Bridget's work here, and I think it's probably third year, she's doing Tudors, but maybe earlier, I don't know. She's been asked to compare the life of a Tudor teenager with a modern teenager, and she's pointing out the similarities and differences between their lives and the way they dress and behave, and her life and the way they dress and behave. And that, too, is an effort to create an understanding of the difference of period, isn't it? So I think those both represent new history. However, the impact... Oh, I also ought to mention that even schools that weren't doing SCHB, there was a shift towards teaching the modern world in GC at O level. It's more contemporary history. And that's a recognition, too, that students were more interested, teenagers were more interested in the modern world than in the 19th century or earlier. However, the impact of new history would probably have been limited without one major development, and that was GCSE. It was the GCSE which universalised new history practices and both systematised and devalued them at the same time. I'll explain what I mean by that. GCSE was a sort of surprising move for the Conservative Party. It had been discussed since the 1970s. Shirley Williams had been too cautious to go forward with a combined O-level and CSE exam under Labour, but the Conservative Education Secretary, Sir Keith Joseph, approved it. And by 1986, the first cohort of students were ready to start what was a new all-ability course. This was a whole ability range, 100%. So it had to cover, you know, from the very able to the least able, which is challenging, actually. The key issue for history was how it would be assessed. So the old way was factual memory, information. New history was on understanding the evidence, explanation. In all respects, new history won the arguments. GCSE was assessed on the basis of their ability to analyse sources. It had coursework, as did SCHP, and it also awarded marks for something called empathy. Now, that's often assumed to be something sort of like the imaginative thing that I was talking about earlier, but it's not actually. In SCHP, empathy was very much about understanding the motivation of historical characters. Why did people make the decisions they did, behaviours they did in the past? However, GCSE was for everyone, all teachers, all student pupils, not just the true believers that attain on SCHP. So when the mass of teachers untrained in SCHP were required to invent coursework assignments around skills in empathy, often, sometimes, they produced essays, produced work from their students that was anachronistic and just embarrassing flights of fantasy, really. Such examples soon discredited empathy. And to some extent, GCSE, especially with the right-wing critics of GCSE, such as Chris McGovern. Now, this is from an interview with Chris McGovern. Chris was on the Radio 4 even the other morning, complaining about how devalued exams have become. Here he says, this is summing up his objection to new history. The problem is, if you're teaching history and asking children to construct the past for themselves, and you've got, say, 10 to 15 hours to teach, what can I say, 1066 to 1500, which is... No, about what it would be. Well, you know, you can't do it because you spent 2 or 3 hours doing Richard III or maybe longer in Princess of the Tower, and there's no time for anything else. And the question then becomes realistically, what's more important to the children? That they get some sort of broad narrative, say 1066 to 1500, or that they look at 2 or 3 things in detail, and by looking at them in detail, they're supposedly acquiring skills for evaluating evidence, which underpins new history. But my view always has been that what defines history as a subject is knowledge of the past. There's nothing else which is unique about it. So that's where new history and its critics now. New history, we're teaching skills, we're teaching thinking skills. Traditionalists, we're teaching knowledge. And that is the critical divide, really. For McGovern and his supporters, GCSE was not only flabby academically, representative portrayal of the real stuff of history in schools, the acquisition of historical knowledge. However, such arguments put little ice with an exam establishment now fully committed. Learning history was about sources, and textbooks reinforced the diet of sources alongside, sometimes even rather than, a narrative. Working out whether a document was biased became as important as knowing the course of events it illuminated. As under O level, the method of assessment tended to dictate the way in which history was taught down the school. So source-based learning became a norm of history teaching throughout secondary school history. Some teachers did this very well, using the opportunity to build up their own source-based materials, which combine knowledge and inquiry effectively. And they were assisted by the availability of a much richer fount of historical evidence in archives and video. It's particularly important from the late 70s onwards, history uses a lot of video. And lastly, of course, on the internet, which has enormous resources of historical archives. If you look at the National Archives website, there's an amazing amount of resource there. This is one of the reasons modern world history has come to dominate GCSE and A-level, because the documentary sources are just too good, too exciting not to use in the classroom. So teachers tend to teach modern history, partly because the sources are very good indeed, and very vivid. But one consequence of studying the sources was a reduction in the scope of history study. Now, there's no denying that. If one is to appreciate the motives of historical actors, evaluate the sources which tell us about their role in events, and look at different historical viewpoints, one must concentrate on particular illustrative events, as SCHP did, rather than the long outline narrative, which of necessity has to be superficial in its coverage. So, by the late 1980s, the triumph of new history, and then the reaction of the national curriculum. Of course, some of the new history enthusiasts were the most vigorous opponents of the national curriculum at the time, but they are now. Everyone I've interviewed has been positive about the national curriculum. Looking back over the last 20 years, and the reason for that was the fact the national curriculum has been good for history, and even good for new history. So what do I mean by that? Well, firstly, it was good for history because it dealt with a number of recognised problems. By the late 1980s, in primary schools, the freeing of the curriculum and the topic-based approach meant less history was taught, and none of it was coherently planned. This was clearly shown by school inspection reports. There was a number of them during the 1980s which showed that the majority of primary schools were not doing a good job in teaching history. Secondly, many children had a disjointed and haphazard experience at secondary level, especially if they moved to school, because of course everyone devised their own curriculum. So repetition could occur, great yawning gaps because they covered something in one school and then the school carried on, they moved on. The national curriculum was able to tackle that by ensuring all children studied the same, or broadly the same, historical content. Thirdly, primary school teachers in particular were given proper training through rushed, no rushed, and good quality materials could be produced to support the common curriculum at both primary and secondary level. The confidence of non-specialists to teach history rose. Fourthly, the national curriculum established some historical content as significant and worthwhile studying. Primary school children got an introduction to ancient civilizations, pre-Norman England and the Victorians or the 1930s, as well as the Tudors and Stuarts. From 11 to 14, pupils studied English and British history from 1066 to the present, alongside topics from European and world history. But this was no route of new history by the right. British history was more emphasised, but crucially, knowledge was not placed centre stage in the curriculum. Instead, historical skills, the use of evidence, and the development of critical thinking about history were the basis for assessment, just as in GCSE. So why wasn't the national curriculum a return to traditional history? Did Mrs. Thatcher, a known supporter of quick factual tests, and Kenneth Baker, a believer in the traditional Whig history, Britain, miss a trick? They certainly vetted the history working group to exclude new history enthusiasts. However, in the event, they still had to rely on people who were experts in the field of history teaching. And the group proved surprisingly cohesive in its belief that there should be no return to testing rote learning in history. The national curriculum did not contain any outline overview. Its content is chronologically arranged, but in units which can be taught quite separately. Moreover, the group made it clear that teachers will be expected to introduce the skills of evidence from the earliest stage. Perhaps the simplest explanation of the success of the working group in winning the argument, so to speak, is that old one, Bendis, my dear boy. The introduction of the national curriculum coincided with a remarkable period of international historical events, the fall of the Berlin Wall and the ending of the Cold War in 1989-91, the ending of apartheid in South Africa, as well as the downfall of Mrs. Thatcher herself and the outbreak of the First Gulf War, all occurred while the history curriculum was being discussed and argued over. Distracting events for politicians, and in fact, during that single period, there were three different education secretaries in office. So the statutory national curriculum for history went forward with a classic compromise. The politicians had insisted on more than 50% British history, but the assessment would be new history. And in fact, the testing regime for the national curriculum was limited to English, maths and science in the end. So history teachers were never constrained to teach to the test. History was the subject most wrangled over, but even before the ink was dry on the national curriculum, the content was being slimmed down, and the proposals for the 14 to 16 age group were dropped. So teachers were left to get on with it, and in the 1990s there's plenty of evidence that history flourished, especially in primary schools, where a real curriculum existed for the first time. In secondary schools also, the national curriculum broke new ground. Most schools would not have taught much European history or any world history topics before 1990. For instance, the teaching of the unique black peoples of the Americas introduced a significant theme of black history onto the curriculum for the first time for the majority of schools. Having once invaded the secret garden of the school curriculum, however, politicians have not been able to leave it alone since then. By the late 1990s, the Labour government had switched priorities from primary schools to literacy and numeracy. Ofsted reports in 2007 and 2011 show that history has, as a consequence, been pushed into the margins of the primary curriculum, or once again merged into topics, and lost its distinctiveness as a subject in many primary schools. Tell you disagreement on this.
I'm just wondering. It's just tiring. I'm sorry. I don't know what time we finish. Is it 2?
Well, it's finished. Five minutes or
right.
So. We have a few questions. Yeah.
So, in secondaries, the promotion of citizenship has squeezed the curriculum space for history, and vocational courses have taken over as a preferred option for the less able. So, the cause of these trends is the preeminence of school league tables. The impact of league tables has not only been to squeeze the time for history, it has forced a more episodic approach to history in the classroom. And teachers have had to select ever more carefully from the national curriculum. This results in hopping between key events. For instance, from the Battle of Hastings to Magna Carta to the play, and then the tubers with little overview of what's in between. And this brings us to the present day. It is, and as in the 60s, very difficult to speak of an average experience of history in schools. The national curriculum has been loosened at each revision in 2000 and 2008. If we compare schools, one might see the differences which can arise depending on the school's priority. One might allocate 2 hours a week in a lower school, another just half a term, maybe once a year, twice a year. In those cases, it's very difficult for teachers to cover the whole curriculum. So have we progressed or declined? Firstly, I think it's always important to reiterate what Jenny said. It's not always the syllabus, the curriculum, it's the good teacher that makes the difference. The Gove-Ferguson thesis is that history is disjointed, lacks chronology, and pupils find it boring. Well, today there are more depth studies, there is more media in the classroom, there is more modern world, but also more of the assessment is based on sources and there's less chronology. That is the case. But on the other hand, it can be exciting and interesting. I'm going to play this one at the end. This is Rosa. Rosa's 20 in her first year at university, but she actually has done new history. She was at school a few years ago. I have to say, in this case, it wasn't a happy experience. It was a sports go.
We did the Battle of Hastings and like acted out the two sides and had to put a case forward for like the French and the British. And we did the feudal system and the doomsday. And that, I remember that was the lots of like drawing.
She's bored.
And playing games. Like, I remember a board game about the feudal system. But then, in year 8, I remember it got really boring. We watched loads of videos, much more than in primary school. And we watched Lawrence of amazing. I can't remember how they tied in, but they were very much meant to. And we learned about like primary sources and secondary sources and all that stuff, but I remember it being really dark. We started off like doing medieval, and then we moved on to the second year. We did Muhammad. Was that after? That's after. Yeah, no, it is, because it's like.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then after that, we did the Industrial Revolution. Oh, and we did the War of the Roses before that. But it was like, you didn't really get a clear sense, and it was really useful, I went really off it. And I was part of it, so I get on with the teacher, but he didn't really like discussion that much. 13 or 14, I didn't really get on with that and didn't enjoy it at all. I found it really boring.
Okay, that's really downbeat to finish, isn't it? But I think it illustrates some of the problems that students can have coping with an episodic approach to history. In her case, she simply hasn't had a good teacher, has she? And if she'd had a charismatic teacher, maybe she would have enjoyed it more. And she's actually very much more positive about her sixth form experience in the whole interview. I think it's worth saying. It's not all negative, and students can come back to it, but it's the teachers that count in the end. But the conundrum is, what should we be going for? And that's, I'll leave that with you, really.
Nicola, Jenny, thank you very much indeed. I think we'll just steal a few minutes first for some questions.
Oh, that's fine.
Do just while we're discussing, just get up and have some coffee and tea and stuff. Just a quick question from me first, that in a sort of comparative sense with other subjects. Now, obviously, history is going to have its history when you get your book published. I just wonder whether there are people doing similar things with other subjects. And also, following on from that, whether there are other subjects which have become as politicised, if you like, as has history. You think of the other humanities, you know, geography and religion, you know, are they as politicised in terms of the curriculum content in the same way that history has?
Well, Ray Walford's written a book about geography. I can't remember when it was published, actually.
It was actually quite a long time ago, and I think it's because of the whole idea of this national narrative and patriotism and citizenship that history has become so politicised, and because there are such different alternative ways of teaching history. I think English is the subject at the IOE. There's a rather different subject.
Yeah, there's a study going on of English. Yes, English. It's based around three schools, but it's looking at progressive ideas in English.
You asked me earlier, didn't you, Matthew?
Science.
There's one article I've come across which actually compares history and science teaching. It's written not that long ago. And it's interesting because the research looked at the way the science teachers approach their subject and the history teachers approach their subject. Now, you think of science as a discovery-based subject in which students are learning the skills of the scientists. They're parodying them, aren't they, in the classroom?
Yeah.
In fact, the science teachers, because they were part of the national curriculum and tested, they approached it very much from a knowledge acquisition viewpoint. Have the students covered whatever? Whereas the history teachers approached it from a skills viewpoint, whereas you see history as the other way, the knowledge one, but it's not. They approach it from their skills. Have they done bias? Have they done this way of using evidence? So that's topsy-turvy, really.
But is that because history is seen as an art rather than a science, and the arts have had this strong emphasis on teaching, well, learning skills rather than learning knowledge?
I think partly that, but also because the scientists are part of the core. And if you're part of the core, that extra demand is placed on you to achieve certain levels of performance by your students. And that leads to penny, bean counting, doesn't it? And to a certain extent, that is affecting history and other subjects. Because recently, we've been attending things like historical association conferences, etc. And what you pick up from teachers is that the more pressure that's put on schools to demonstrate improvement at every year that the students are going through, the more you have to measure them. And the more you measure them, the more you're led to instrumental approaches to teaching. So, countering that's difficult. So you're then trying to estimate what level they're at, and there is this thing called levelling students. I mean, science teachers will have to do it as well, maths teachers, English teachers, all teachers have to do it. In the non-examine, the non-stats areas, it wasn't so important, but I think that the stress on continuous improvement at every stage and on measuring students has led to more of that levelling. And inevitably, you're just trying to measure things, and it leads you to be instrumental, because so many things about students' learning is not are not measurable.
I think one of the other problems is because, as I was trying to say in my ambition for the presentation, there are so many demands of what could be taught in history as far as knowledge goes, that in some ways it's almost easier to look at, I suppose, try and teach skills and in a way lead pupils to go off and get the knowledge themselves later. Because, I mean, by the 60s, the demands for knowledge were just phenomenal. You know, they've got to learn the whole of British history, world history, development of the United Nations, as someone has talked about. I mean, there were just endless things. So in a sense, I see new history as almost coming back down to paring out all the knowledge and just concentrating on the skills. But the other thing is that there has been histories of religious teaching, and there are David Crookburn stuff about history of R.I. Just on
Rob Freebie's been doing stuff on citizenship and religious studies. I mean, religious education is another politically important one.
Thank
you so much. Thank you very much. It was really, really interesting. The work I do, I'm a writer, and I work with museums to support teachers to teach controversial history, so around something like British transatlantic enslavement, and just to look at why that can be so difficult to teach. And I mean, the National Maritime Museum has done a lot of work where they've worked with pupils and the teachers. And part of their study says that the children, the young people, are really keen to learn about this very difficult history. But the teachers feel that they don't want to get it wrong. They feel very scared of the history. But I was really interested in everything that you had to say, but going back to something you said really early on, which is, what is history meant to achieve? Mm-hmm. So this idea that there is all this knowledge that the young people have to take on, but the fundamental question still seems to be, why?
It's an important point you raised. I mean, I didn't say anything about it, but there's been a big shift towards teaching what you might call politically relevant history. And most people would do transatlantic slave trade and then follow it by the civil rights movement in the US. They don't teach the Windrush generation immigration in Britain. In fact, John D. Clare is a textbook writer as well. And he'd written a textbook about the Windrush generation immigration to Britain for schools, and it hasn't sold at all well. Because people, it's too difficult, it's too immediate. Whereas civil rights in the US, it's sort of over there, but it's a good topic to relate to it.
Exactly. But that difficulty is about what might happen now.
That's right.
And it's interesting that history and citizenship, that it's just perfect, actually.
Yeah.
To teach citizenship using history, but that there's all this fear around what might come up.
Yeah.
And I think young people can feel it. You know, the lady that you have, Rosa, the boredom in her voice was just a dampening down of something as well, it felt to me. Something was being repressed. Because young people, I know that the charismatic teacher is really important, but I feel, when I've worked with young people around history, they can't wait to know. They do want to know the stories, but the resources are also very important to them, and they absolutely can't wait. But something gets held back and repressed, I think, anyway.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Why is it so hard? People have been, you know, hundreds of years people have been trying to lick this one. Why is it still so hard?
The lack of time, I think, is one of the big issues. You know, time to cover all the different things.
I don't think it's practical, personally.
You don't.
What about like the French system, where if it's, you know, what is it? Yeah, it's the 18th of May, so we'll be on page 494 of the book on whatever.
Yeah.
So, you know, that ensures that the stuff, as it were, gets covered. That's a very different approach.
But it's what they thought the cushion
was going to be like.
Originally, but obviously it eventually got diverted completely.
I mean, it is to a certain extent, in that there is a lot more commonality. And it enabled publishers and heritage sites and museums, for instance, to then produce lots of materials and programmes geared to something they knew a lot of children would be studying. And it's been a real benefit from that point of view. But I don't think Britain would ever have been like that. I mean, there's never been a prescribed textbook. There's any number of textbooks.
Quite centralised.
Yeah.
Any other quick points anyone would like to make? We do need to.
Can I ask?
Yeah, please, do.
When we talk about what we should teach and how should teach, but, you know, we're always missing who should be teaching. So, you know, how about the teacher training? How you changed it before the history and the new history? And there must be the PGC or some teacher training course that should be transformed eventually. But it's missing, you know, what the teacher training course they had in the past and then now they...
That's probably a whole other
study.
It's a huge
area. I mean, we have both written papers about teacher training, and that's absolutely true. Teacher training was a critical factor in introducing new history in the 60s. There's a big expansion in teacher training with the three-year teacher qualification came in, and then the BEds in the 70s, four-year degrees. And it meant that more and more teachers were introduced to the new ideas. Yeah. So it's a critical factor.
Teacher training before the 1960s. Was what? I mean, what?
It was a two-year course, wasn't it?
There was a two-year
There was a two-year course for people who went straight into teacher training. But if you're
from what level? From the training beforehand.
Well, actually, you could go in at. Well, there were all kinds of different paths into teaching, and there were emergency quick ones. But basically, you could go in from, I think it was about 17. It was kind of post-GCSE. Or post school certificate, which is what they took before the Second World War. And graduates didn't have to do any kind of training at all. So at that point, if you were a graduate, you could go into either primary or secondary teaching. I mean, obviously, schools would give preference, particularly in primary
schools. Would you have to teach the subject that you graduated in?
Well, depends how. I mean, we've got survey forms from certainly teachers in secondary. I mean, I've got. I can remember a survey form from somebody who was teaching a secondary model in the late 40s, and he'd done a degree in RR, religious studies, RS, and he ended up teaching, in fact, he ended up very fast, he was head of history in the secondary model, and he was the only teacher in history, but he was also head of history. So you didn't even have to teach your degree subjects. I mean, it was basically, there was a shortage of teachers in many areas, and it was what you could talk your way into, really.
What was needed? I mean, Eric was the same. He was described at his early career. He was just shunted around by the local authority to where there was a gap, and he taught all sorts of things. In grammar, it wasn't more he taught the subject.
I think at that point we'll have to stop the form a bit, but can we just thank you again, Nicola and Jenny, for your duo this afternoon. The book's going to be out soon. I'm sure it's the kind of book that's going to get picked up by Radio 4, get picked up by Melvin Bragg. Just make sure that David Cannadine doesn't get all the glory, that you get on there as well, because you've clearly done a lot of the hard work in oral history here. So thanks very much for this preview of it. It's been great. Thank you.